Chapter 21, of Antony the Monk. What sort of a man the monk Antony was, who lived in the same age, in the Egyptian desert, and how he openly contended with devils, clearly detecting their devices and wily modes of warfare, and how he performed many miracles, it would be superfluous for us to say, for Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, has anticipated us, having devoted an entire book to his biography. One of such good men there was a large number at one time during the years of the Emperor Constantine. Chapter 22, Manes, the founder of the Manichaean heresy, and on his origin. But amidst the good wheat, tares are accustomed to spring up, for envy loves to plot insidiously against the good. Hence it was that a little while before the time of Constantine, a species of heathenish Christianity made its appearance together with that which was real, just as false prophets sprang up among the true, and false apostles among the true apostles. For at that time a dogma of Empedocles, the heathen philosopher, by means of Manichaeus, assumed the form of Christian doctrine. Eusebius Pamphilus has indeed mentioned this person in the seventh book of his ecclesiastical history, one but has not entered into minute details concerning him. Wherefore, I deem it incumbent on me to supply some particulars which he has left unnoticed. Thus it will be known who this Manichaeus was, whence he came, and what was the nature of his presumptuous daring. A Saracen named Scythian married a captive from the Upper Thebes. On her account he dwelt in Egypt, and having versed himself in the learning of the Egyptians, he subtly introduced the theory of Empedocles and Pythagoras among the doctrines of the Christian faith, asserting that there were two natures, a good and an evil one. He termed, as Empedocles had done, the latter discord, and the former friendship. Of this Scythian, Buddhas, who had been previously called Terebinthus, became a disciple, and he having proceeded to Babylon, which the Persians inhabit, made many extravagant statements respecting himself, declaring that he was born of a virgin, and brought up in the mountains. The same man afterwards composed four books, one he entitled The Mysteries, another The Gospel, a third The Treasure, and the fourth Head Summaries, but pretending to perform some mystic rites, he was hurled down a precipice by a spirit, too, and so perished. A certain woman at whose house he had lodged buried him, and taking possession of his property, bought a boy about 7 years old whose name was Cubricus. This lad she enfranchised, and having given him a liberal education, she soon after died, leaving him all that belonged to Terebinthus, including the books he had written on the principles inculcated by Scythian. Cubricus, the freedman, taking these things with him and having withdrawn into the regions of Persia, changed his name, calling himself Manes, and disseminated the books of Buddhas or Terebinthus among his deluded followers as his own. Now the contents of these treatises apparently agree with Christianity in expression, but are pagan in sentiment, for Manichaeus, being an atheist, incited his disciples to acknowledge a plurality of gods, and taught them to worship the sun. He also introduced the doctrine of fate, denying human free will, and affirmed a transmutation three of bodies, clearly following the opinions of Empedocles, Pythagoras, and the Egyptians. He denied that Christ existed in the flesh, asserting that he was an apparition, and rejected moreover the law and the prophets, calling himself the Comforter. All of which dogmas are totally at variance with the orthodox faith of the Church. In his epistles he even dared to call himself an apostle, but for a pretension so unfounded he brought upon himself merited retribution in the following manner. The son of the Persian monarch having been attacked with disease, his father became anxious for his recovery, and left no means untried in order to effect it, and as he had heard of the wonder-working of Manichaeus, and thinking that these miracles were real, he sent for him as an apostle, trusting that through him his son might be restored. He accordingly presented himself at court, and with his assumed manner undertook the treatment of the young prince. But the king, seeing that the child died in his hands, shut up the deceiver in prison, with the intention of putting him to death. However, he contrived to escape, and fled into Mesopotamia. But the king of Persia, having discovered that he was dwelling there, caused him to be brought thence by force, and after having raided him alive, He stuffed his skin with chaff, and suspended it in front of the gate of the city. These things we state not having manufactured them ourselves, but collected from a book entitled The Disputation of Archelaus, Bishop of Kaskara, one of the cities of Mesopotamia. For Archelaus himself states that he disputed with Manichaeus face to face, and mentions the circumstances connected with his life to which we have now alluded. Envy thus delights, as we before remarked, to be insidiously at work in the midst of a prosperous condition of affairs. But for what reason the goodness of God permits this to be done, whether he wishes thereby to bring into activity the excellence of the principles of the Church, and to utterly break down the self-importance which is wont to unite itself with faith, or for what other cause, is, at the same time, a difficult question, and not relevant to the present discussion. For our object is neither to examine the soundness of doctrinal views, nor to analyze the mysterious reasons for the providences and judgments of God, but to detail as faithfully as possible the history of transactions which have taken place in the churches. The way in which the superstition of the Manichaeans sprang up a little before the time of Constantine has been thus described. Now let us return to the times and events which are the proper subjects of this history. Chapter 23. Eusebius, Bishop of Nicomedia, and Theognis, Bishop of Nicaea, having recovered confidence, endeavor to subvert the Nicene Creed by plotting against Athanasius. The partisans of Eusebius and Theognis having returned from their exile, these latter were reinstated in their churches, having expelled, as we observed, those who had been ordained in their stead. Moreover, they came into great consideration with the emperor, who honored them exceedingly, as those who had returned from error to the orthodox faith. They, however, abused the license thus afforded them, by exciting greater commotions in the world than they had done before, being instigated to this by two causes: on the one hand the Arian heresy with which they had been previously infected, and bitter animosity against Athanasius on the other, because he had so vigorously withstood them in the synod while the articles of faith were under discussion. And in the first place they objected to the ordination of Athanasius partly as a person unworthy of the prelacy, and partly because he had been elected by disqualified persons. But when Athanasius had shown himself superior to this calumny for having assumed control of the Church of Alexandria, he ardently contended for the Nicene Creed. Then Eusebius exerted himself to the utmost insidiously to cause the removal of Athanasius and to bring Arius back to Alexandria, for he thought that thus only he should be able to expunge the doctrine of consubstantiality, and introduce Arianism. Eusebius therefore wrote to Athanasius, desiring him to readmit Arius and his adherents into the church. Now the tone of his letter indeed was that of entreaty, but openly he menaced him. And as Athanasius would by no means accede to this, he endeavored to induce the emperor to give Arius an audience, and then permit him to return to Alexandria, and by what means he attained his object, I shall mention in its proper place. Meanwhile, before this, another commotion was raised in the church. In fact, her own children again disturbed her peace. Eusebius Pamphilus says, one that immediately after the synod, Egypt became agitated by intestine divisions, not assigning, however, the reason for this, so that hence he has won the reputation of disingenuousness, and of avoiding to specify the causes of these dissensions, from a determination on his part not to give his sanction to the proceedings at Nicaea. Yet, as we ourselves have discovered from various letters which the bishops wrote to one another after the synod, the term homousios troubled some of them, so that while they occupied themselves in a two-minute investigation of its import, they roused the strife against each other. It seemed not unlike a contest in the dark, for neither party appeared to understand distinctly the grounds on which they calumniated one another. Those who objected to the word homousios conceived that those who approved it favored the opinion of Sabius II and Motinus III. They therefore called them blasphemers, as subverting the existence of the Son of God. And again the advocates of this term, charging their opponents with polytheism, inveighed against them as introducers of heathen superstitions. Astartheus, Bishop of Antioch, accuses Eusebius Pamphilus of perverting the Nicene Creed. Eusebius again denies that he violates that exposition of the faith, and recriminates, saying that Eustathius was a defender of the opinion of Sabius. In consequence of these misunderstandings, each of them wrote as if contending against adversaries, and although it was admitted on both sides that the Son of God has a distinct person and existence, and all acknowledged that there is one God in three persons, yet from what cause I am unable to divine, they could not agree among themselves, and therefore could in no way endure to be at peace. Chapter 24, of the Synod held at Antioch, which deposed Eustathius, bishop of Antioch, on whose account a sedition broke out and almost ruined the city. Having therefore convened a synod at Antioch, they deposed Eustathius, as a supporter of the Sabian heresy, rather than of the tenets which the council at Nicaea had formulated. Some affirm this measure was taken for other and unsatisfactory reasons, though none other have been openly assigned. This is a matter of common occurrence. The bishops are accustomed to do this in all cases, accusing and pronouncing impious those whom they depose, but not explaining their warrant for so doing. George, bishop of Laodicea in Syria, one of the number of those who abominated the term homousios, assures us in his Encomium of Eusebius Imisnews, that they deposed Eustathius as favouring Sabianism. On the impeachment of Cyrus, bishop of Berea, of Eusebius Imisnews we shall speak elsewhere in due order. 1. George has written of Eustathius somewhat inconsistently, for after asserting that he was accused by Cyrus of maintaining the heresy of Sabius, he tells us again that Cyrus himself was convicted of the same error, and degraded for it. Now how was it possible that Cyrus should accuse Eustathius as a Sabian, when he inclined to Sabianism himself? It appears likely therefore that Eustathius must have been condemned on other grounds. At that time, however, there arose a dangerous sedition at Antioch on account of his deposition, for when they proceeded to the election of a successor, so fierce a dissension was kindled, as to threaten the whole city with destruction. The populace was divided into two factions, one of which vehemently contended for the translation of Eusebius Pamphilus from Caesarea in Palestine to Antioch, the other equally insisted on the reinstatement of Eustathius. And the populace of the city were infected with the spirit of partisanship in this quarrel among the Christians. A military force was arrayed on both sides with hostile intent, so that a bloody collision would have taken place, had not God and the dread of the emperor repressed the violence of the multitude. For the emperor threw letters, and Eusebius, by refusing to accept the bishopric, served to allay the ferment, on which account that prelate was exceedingly admired by the emperor, who wrote to him commending his prudent determination, and congratulating him as one who was considered worthy of being bishop not of one city merely, but of almost the whole world. Consequently it is said that the episcopal chair of the church at Antioch was vacant for 8 consecutive years after this period, 2 but at length by the exertions of those who aimed at the subversion of the Nicene Creed, Euphronius was duly installed. This is the amount of my information respecting the synod held at Antioch on account of Eustathius. Immediately after these events Eusebius, who had long before left Berytus, and was at that time presiding over the church at Nicomedia, strenuously exerted himself in connection to those of his party, to bring back Arius to Alexandria. But how they managed to effect this, and by what means the emperor was prevailed on to admit both Arius and with him Uzoas into his presence must now be related. Chapter 25, of the presbyter who exerted himself for the recall of Arius. 1. The emperor Constantine had a sister named Constantia, the widow of Licinius, who had for some time shared the imperial dignity with Constantine, but had assumed tyrannical powers and had been put to death in consequence. This princess maintained in her household establishment a certain confidential presbyter, tinctured with the dogmas of Arianism. Eusebius and others having prompted him, he took occasion in his familiar conversations with Constantia to insinuate that the synod had done Arius injustice, and that the common report concerning him was not true. Constantia gave full credence to the presbyter's assertions, but durst not report them to the emperor. Now it happened that she became dangerously ill, and her brother visited her daily. As the disease became aggravated and she expected to die, she commended this presbyter to the emperor, testifying to his diligence and piety, as well as his devoted loyalty to his sovereign. She died soon after, whereupon the presbyter became one of the most confidential persons about the emperor, and having gradually increased in freedom of speech, he repeated to the emperor what he had before stated to his sister, affirming that Arius had no other views than the sentiments avowed by the synod, and that if he were admitted to the imperial presence, he would give his full assent to what the synod had decreed. He added, moreover, that he had been unreasonably slandered. The presbyter's words appeared strange to the emperor, and he said, if Arius subscribes with the synod and holds its views, I will both give him an audience, and send him back to Alexandria with honor. Having thus said, he immediately wrote to him in these words, Victor Constantine Maximus Augustus, to Arius. It was intimated to your reverence some time since, that you might come to my court, in order to obtain an interview with us. We are not a little surprised that you did not do this immediately. Wherefore, having at once mounted a public vehicle, hasten to arrive at our court, that when you have experienced our clemency and regard for you, you may return to your own country. May God protect you, beloved. Dated the 25th of November. This was the letter of the emperor to Arius. And I cannot but admire the ardent zeal which the prince manifested for religion, for it appears from this document that he had often before exhorted Arius to change his views, inasmuch as he censures his delaying to return to the truth, although he had himself written frequently to him. Now on the receipt of this letter, Arius came to Constantinople accompanied by Uzoas, whom Alexander had divested of his deaconship when he excommunicated Arius and his partisans. The emperor accordingly admitted them to his presence, and asked them whether they would agree to the creed. And when they readily gave their assent, he ordered them to deliver to him a written statement of their faith. Chapter 26. Arius, on being recalled, presents a recantation to the emperor, and pretends to accept the Nicene Creed. They having drawn up a declaration to the following effect, presented it to the emperor. Arius and Uzoas, to our most religious and pious lord, the emperor Constantine. In accordance with the command of your devout piety, sovereign lord, we declare our faith, and before God profess in writing, that we and our adherents believe as follows. We believe in one God the Father Almighty, and in the Lord Jesus Christ his Son, who was begotten one of him before all ages, God the Word through whom all things were made, both those which are in the heavens and those upon the earth, who descended, and became incarnate, and suffered, and rose again, ascended into the heavens, and will again come to judge the living and the dead. We believe also in the Holy Spirit, and in the resurrection of the flesh, and in the life of the coming age, and in the kingdom of the heavens, and in one Catholic Church of God, extending from one end of the earth to the other. This faith we have received from the Holy Gospels, the Lord therein saying to his disciples, to go and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. If we do not so believe and truly receive the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, as the whole Catholic Church and the Holy Scriptures teach, in which we believe in every respect, God is our judge both now, and in the coming judgment. Wherefore we beseech your piety, most devout emperor, that we who are persons consecrated to the ministry, and holding the faith and sentiments of the Church and of the Holy Scriptures, may by your pacific and devoted piety be reunited to our mother, the Church, all superfluous questions and disputings being avoided, that so both we and the whole Church being at peace, may in common offer our accustomed prayers for your tranquil reign, and on behalf of your whole family. Chapter 27. Arius having returned to Alexandria with the emperor's consent, and not being received by Athanasius, the partisans of Eusebius bring many charges against Athanasius before the emperor. Arius having thus satisfied the emperor, returned to Alexandria. But his artifice for suppressing the truth did not succeed, for on his arrival at Alexandria, as Athanasius would not receive him, but turned away from him as a pest. He attempted to excite a fresh commotion in that city by disseminating his heresy. Then indeed both Eusebius himself wrote, and prevailed on the emperor also to write, in order that Arius and his partisans might be readmitted into the church. Athanasius nevertheless wholly refused to receive them, and wrote to inform the emperor in reply, that it was impossible for those who had once rejected the faith, and had been anathematized, to be again received into communion on their return. But the emperor, provoked at this answer, menaced Athanasius in these terms: "Since you have been apprised of my will, afford unhindered access into the church to all those who are desirous of entering it. For if it shall be intimated to me that you have prohibited any of those claiming to be reunited to the church, or have hindered their admission, I will forthwith send someone who at my command shall depose you, and drive you into exile." The emperor wrote thus from a desire of promoting the public good, and because he did not wish to see the church ruptured, for he labored earnestly to bring them all into harmony. Then indeed the partisans of Eusebius, ill disposed towards Athanasius, imagining they had found a seasonable opportunity, welcomed the emperor's displeasure as an auxiliary to their own purpose, and on this account they raised a great disturbance, endeavoring to eject him from his bishopric, for they entertained the hope that the Arian doctrine would prevail only upon the removal of Athanasius. The chief conspirators against him were Eusebius, bishop of Nicomedia, Theognis of Nicaea, Maries of Chalcedon, Ursacius of Singidnum in Upper Mcia, and Valens of Mercia in Upper Pannonia. These persons suborned by bribes certain of the Molossian heresy to fabricate various charges against Athanasius, and first they accuse him through the Molossian Zision, Eudemon and Callinicus, of having ordered the Egyptians to pay a linen garment as tribute to the church at Alexandria. But this calumny was immediately disproved by Alypius and Macarius, presbyters of the Alexandrian church, who then happened to be at Nicomedia, they having convinced the emperor that these statements to the prejudice of Athanasius were false. Wherefore the emperor by letter severely censured his accusers, but urged Athanasius to come to him. But before he came, the Eusebian faction, anticipating his arrival, added to their former accusation the charge of another crime of a still more serious nature than the former, charging Athanasius with plotting against his sovereign, and with having sent for treasonable purposes a chest full of gold to one Philumenes. When, however, the emperor had himself investigated this matter at Samathia, which is in the suburbs of Nicomedia, and had found Athanasius innocent, he dismissed him with honor, and wrote with his own hand to the church at Alexandria to assure them that their bishop had been falsely accused. It would indeed have been both proper and desirable to have passed over in silence the subsequent attacks which the Eusebians made upon Athanasius, lest from these circumstances the Church of Christ should be judged unfavorably of by those who are adverse to its interests. One, but since having been already committed to writing, they have become known to everybody, I have on that account deemed it necessary to make as cursory allusion to these things as possible, the particulars of which would require a special treatise. Whence the slanderous accusation originated, and the character of those who devised it, I shall now therefore state in brief. Marcotes too is a district of Alexandria, there are contained in it very many villages, and an abundant population, with numerous splendid churches. These churches are all under the jurisdiction of the Bishop of Alexandria, and are subject to his city as parishes. Three, there was in this region a person named Isaharas, who had been guilty of an act deserving of many deaths. For although he had never been admitted to holy orders, he had the audacity to assume the title of presbyter, and to exercise sacred functions belonging to the priesthood. But having been detected in his sacrilegious career, he made his escape thence and sought refuge in Nicomedia, where he implored the protection of the party of Eusebius, who from their hatred to Athanasius, not only received him as a presbyter, but even promised to confer upon him the dignity of the episcopacy, if he would frame an accusation against Athanasius, listening as a pretext for this to whatever stories Isserus had invented. For he spread a report that he had suffered dreadfully in consequence of an assault, and that Macarius had rushed furiously toward the altar, had overturned the table, and broken a mystical cup. He added also that he had burnt the sacred books. As a reward for this accusation, the Eusebian faction, as I have said, promised him a bishopric, foreseeing that the charges against Macarius would involve, along with the accused party, Athanasius, under whose orders he would seem to have acted. But this charge they formulated later. Before it they devised another full of the bitterest malignity, to which I shall now advert. Having by some means, I know not what, obtained a man's hand, whether they themselves had murdered anyone, and cut off his hand, or had severed it from some dead body, God knows, and the authors of the deed, but be that as it may, they publicly exposed it as the hand of Arsenius, a Milesian bishop, while they kept the alleged owner of it concealed. This hand, they asserted, had been made use of by Athanasius in the performance of certain magic arts, and therefore it was made the gravest ground of accusation which these calumniators had concerted against him. But as it generally happens, all those who entertained any pique against Athanasius came forward at the same time with a variety of other charges. When the emperor was informed of these proceedings, he wrote to his nephew Dalmatius the censor, who then had his residence at Antioch in Syria, directing him to order the accused parties to be brought before him, and after due investigation, to inflict punishment on such as might be convicted. He also sent thither Eusebius and Theognis, that the case might be tried in their presence. When Athanasius knew that he was to be summoned before the censor, he sent into Egypt to make a strict search after Arsenius, and he ascertained indeed that he was secreted there, but was unable to apprehend him, because he often changed his place of concealment. Meanwhile the emperor suppressed the trial which was to have been held before the censor, on the following account. Chapter 28. On account of the charges against Athanasius, the emperor convokes a synod of bishops at. The emperor had ordered a synod of bishops to be present at the consecration of the church which he had erected at Jerusalem. He therefore directed that, as a secondary matter, they should on their way first assemble at Tyre, to examine into the charges against Athanasius, in order that all cause of contention being removed there, they might the more peacefully perform the inaugural ceremonies one in the dedication of the Church of God. This was the 30th year of Constantine's reign, and 60 bishops were thus convened at Tyre from various places, on the summons of Dionysius the consul. As to Macarius the presbyter, he was conducted from Alexandria in chains, under a military escort, while Athanasius was unwilling to go thither, not so much from dread, because he was innocent of the charges made, as because he feared lest any innovations should be made on the decisions of the council at Nicaea. He was, however, constrained to be present by the menacing letters of the emperor, for it had been written him that if he did not come voluntarily, he should be brought by force. Chapter 29. Of Arsenius, and his hand which was said to have been cut off. The special providence of God drove Arsenius also to Tyre, for, disregarding the injunctions he had received from the accusers who had bribed him, he went thither disguised to see what would be done. It by some means happened that the servants of Archelaus, the governor of the province, heard some persons at an inn affirm that Arsenius, who was reported to have been murdered, was concealed in the house of one of the citizens. Having heard this and marked the individuals by whom this statement was made, they communicated the information to their master, who, causing strict search to be made for the man immediately, discovered and properly secured him, after which he gave notice to Athanasius that he need not be under any alarm, inasmuch as Arsenius was alive and the present. Arsenius, on being apprehended, at first denied that he was the person, but Paul, bishop of Tyre, who had formerly known him, established his identity. Divine providence having thus disposed matters, Athanasius was shortly after summoned by the synod, and as soon as he presented himself, his traducers exhibited the hand, and pressed their charge. He managed the affair with great prudence, for he inquired of those present, as well as of his accusers, who were the persons who knew Arsenius, and several having answered that they knew him, He caused Arsenius to be introduced, having his hands covered by his cloak. Then he again asked them, "Is this the person who has lost a hand?" All were astonished at the unexpectedness of this procedure, except those who knew whence the hand had been cut off, for the rest thought that Arsenius was really deficient of a hand, and expected that the accused would make his defense in some other way. But Athanasius turning back the cloak of Arsenius on one side showed one of the man's hands, again, while some were supposing that the other hand was wanting, permitting them to remain a short time in doubt. Afterward he turned back the cloak on the other side and exposed the other hand. Then addressing himself to those present, he said, "Arsenius, as you see, is found to have two hands. Let my accusers show the place whence the third was cut off." 1. Chapter 30. Athanasius is found innocent of what he was accused, his accusers take to flight. Matters having been brought to this issue with regard to Arsenius, the contrivers of this imposture were reduced to perplexity, and Achab, one who was also called John, one of the principal accusers, having slipped out of court in the tumult, effected his escape. Thus Athanasius cleared himself from this charge, without having recourse to any pleading, too, for he was confident that the sight only of Arsenius alive would confound his calumniators. Chapter 31. When the bishops will not listen to Athanasius's defense and the second charge, he betakes himself to the emperor. But in refuting the false allegations against Macarius, he made use of legal forms, taking exception in the first place to Arcebius and his party, as his enemies, protesting against the injustice of any man's being tried by his adversaries. He next insisted on its being proved that his accuser Issarus had really obtained the dignity of presbyter, for so he had been designated in the indictment. But as the judges would not allow any of these objections, the case of Macarius was entered into, and the informers being found deficient of proofs, the hearing of the matter was postponed, until some persons should have gone into Mariotis, in order that all doubtful points might be examined on the spot. Athanasius, seeing that those very individuals were to be sent to whom he had taken exception for the persons sent were Theognis, Mares, Theodorus, Macedonius, Valens, and Ursacius, exclaimed that their procedure was both treacherous and fraudulent, for that it was unjust that the presbyter Macarius should be detained in bonds, while the accuser together with the judges who were his adversaries were permitted to go, in order that an ex parte collection of the facts in evidence might be made. Having made this protest before the whole synod and Dionysius the governor of the province, and finding that no one paid any attention to his appeal, he privately withdrew. Those, therefore, who were sent to Mariotis, having made an ex parte investigation, held that what the accuser said was true. Dash.